from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at how the federal budget could impact people on Medicaid seeking reproductive health care. Then we'll look at how Milwaukee is preparing to take in and support people coming to the Midwest due to climate change.
People will move because of a changing climate. And I think that a place like Milwaukee is ripe to reap the benefits in terms of population growth of that movement.
Plus, learn about cuts at the 16th Street Health Centers on Milwaukee's south side.
16th Street's Department of Environmental Health was one of the first in the nation. It's very unusual to have a federally qualified community health center with a dedicated team of folks that are getting into the community, doing that upstream work.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. The federal budget bill currently before Congress would bar people with Medicaid from accessing reproductive health care at organizations that provide abortions. That is, if it passes in its current form. Michelle Velasquez is Chief Strategy Officer of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin. She speaks to WUWM's Mayon Silver about what that would mean for care.
If it passes, this federal budget bill would prevent Medicaid recipients from getting reproductive health care at Planned Parenthood. Is that what people mean when they say defunding Planned Parenthood? And what would that mean exactly for your organization?
That's exactly what people mean when they say defund Planned Parenthood. I think for years there's been this assumption or presumption that Planned Parenthoods nationally just sort of get a bucket of money. And so when they say defund, they're taking away just some sort of grants or things like that. But Planned Parenthood is a healthcare provider. And just like any other healthcare provider, bills insurance companies. And some of our patients have private pay insurance. And many of our patients have different Medicaid programs as their insurance coverage. So what this bill would do would be to exclude Planned Parenthood from being a Medicaid provider. And therefore, any person with Medicaid as their form of healthcare insurance coverage would be unable to seek those services at Planned Parenthood.
And so a little context on Medicaid and who uses it. It's a safety net provider insurance. It covers nearly 80 million low-income folks and people with disabilities in 50 states. Not all of those people, of course, need reproductive health care. But if passed, this current federal budget bill would restrict them from getting reproductive health care from providers that also offer abortions. What would that mean for people in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's a great question. So I just want to make sure to be really clear, no Medicaid dollars are spent on abortion coverage. So those services are not refundable by Medicaid, except in very, very few circumstances that I won't really go into. But needless to say, very small group of exceptions. The vast majority of abortion care is not covered by Medicaid insurance. So when we're talking about people being restricted from using Planned Parenthood, they will be restricted from accessing birth control, STI testing and treatment, well women's exams, cancer screenings, vasectomies, gender-affirming care, PEP and PrEP, HIV testing, et cetera, et cetera. And so in Wisconsin, what that means is anywhere from about 50,000 to 60,000 people would no longer potentially have access to the services at Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, because that is on average about how many Wisconsinites seek various kinds of sexual and reproductive health care from one of our 21 brick-and-mortar health centers or our virtual health center as well.
What do you think that would mean? Like, what's the healthcare landscape like in Wisconsin? You know, if people on Medicaid, those 50 to 60,000 people, obviously, again, not all of them are accessing reproductive healthcare, but probably tens of thousands are.
Those are actually patients, that 50 to 60,000 number, are accessing health services at Planned Parenthood. So there's far more people in Wisconsin that receive some form of state Medicaid coverage, often known as Badger Care, or there is also a family planning only form of Medicaid that we use an acronym FPAS for. And so that number, 50 to 60,000, is actually just the number of people that are seen by Planned Parenthood health centers across the state in a given year. So the last few years, we've averaged about 50,000. I think some of those numbers right pre-COVID and right after COVID were about 60,000. So we're talking about tens of thousands of people who are seeking out those sexual and reproductive health care services who would not have access to Planned Parenthood. And the reason is because, as you mentioned, Planned Parenthood is a safety net healthcare provider. So the majority of our patients have Medicaid as their form of insurance coverage, so about 60 to 70%. And so if Planned Parenthood cannot essentially bill and be reimbursed by Medicaid, that will necessarily mean that some or many of our health centers will need to close. Now, the question is, you know, are there other places where people can access this care? I don't think so. I mean, yes, there are other healthcare providers, of course, across the state, and many of these services they all provide. But we're talking about people who have really significant challenges accessing sort of other types of healthcare systems, who will either wait a long time to get appointments or just not have really any alternatives. Some of our health centers are located in more rural areas. There's certainly a challenge getting health services in rural parts of the state. So I don't think there is any one healthcare system that could absorb the number of patients that Planned Parenthood sees for these types of healthcare. And many people will just go without that care. This will ultimately be much more expensive for not just the state of Wisconsin, but the federal government as well. I think the CBO estimated about a $300 million cost to the government for defunding Planned Parenthood over a 10-year period of time.
You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm WWM's Maayan Silver, speaking with Michelle Velasquez. She is Chief Strategy Officer with Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin and Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin. And for a skeptic who, like you said, thinks that there will be other places that people can access this reproductive health care, what would you say to them? I mean, how do you know there aren't enough providers to absorb these patients, like in the specific provider landscape in Wisconsin?
So I'll go back a little bit. This is before I worked at Planned Parenthood, but there was a time when Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin closed, had to close a health center in Shawano. And in the five-year period following that closure, STI rates went up by 42% in that area, as opposed to in neighboring similarly situated counties, a much lower rate of STI increases. And so I think that sort of illustrates that there aren't others sort of picking up these patients and I think that's for a variety of reasons. Planned Parenthood is well known. It is trusted. It is seen as a community resource and safety net healthcare provider where, you know, most healthcare organizations have a payer mix of privately insured and publicly insured people, but more privately insured people. The reverse is true for Planned Parenthood, where the vast majority of patients are insured through Medicaid or not insured at all. And as I mentioned, public health departments have played an important role in sexual and reproductive health care, but they have limited resources as well and don't do the full scope of services. And we're also seeing those dollars being taken away from those important programs. So it's really going to impact all of us, but certainly those who are, you know, most vulnerable in our communities.
Out of curiosity, in red states where abortion is banned and Planned Parenthood there only provides general reproductive health care and not abortions, would Medicaid patients still be restricted from receiving their services?
That's a really fantastic question. That remains to be seen. The way this bill is written is really targeting Planned Parenthood as an organization because it provides abortion. So, you know, Roe was overturned. It's been nearly 3 years already since the Dobbs decision. And the idea was that each state would be able to decide for itself whether or not to protect or restrict or ban abortion completely. But what this bill does is essentially, in my opinion, create sort of a backdoor abortion ban across the country because it is singling out Planned Parenthood as an abortion provider, and therefore it cannot be a Medicaid-covered entity, despite the fact that in many states, abortion has remained legal by decision-making of those individual states. And so the way this bill is written, it indicates that, you know, any nonprofit organization that is primarily engaged in essential community health care, in sexual reproductive health services, that has billed Medicaid, at least any of its affiliates or subsidiaries have billed Medicaid in fiscal year 24, at least $1 million, and also provide abortion, are no longer eligible. So I think the sort of key there is to, you know, that we'll see down the road is what does it mean under this law to be affiliated? How is that going to be interpreted? Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin is a member of the national office, the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, but it operates as its own legal entity. It's its own nonprofit status with its own board, its own governing rules and documents, and of course adheres to the certain guidelines that are required to be a member of the Federation. But we will, I think, see some legal battles about what does it mean to be affiliated. The other part I would note is that in some states, some red states where Planned Parenthood is not able to provide abortion care because of the state laws, they've also been written out of those state Medicaid plans. And so there are some affiliates, some members of Planned Parenthood Federation that are not able to bill their state Medicaid at all either. And they operate but a much smaller footprint than what we have in Wisconsin. And I don't have access to it in this moment, but I know that there have been some studies done in both Texas and Indiana about, you know, sort of changes in people's health and access post defunding Planned Parenthood in those states.
Interesting. Okay, so of course this particular bill is before the U.S. Senate currently, and it's going to have to go back to the House if there's any changes, because both houses have to pass it identically. Do you know anything so far about the discussions in the Senate, or specifically, what do you think about Wisconsin Senators Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin both being a no on this bill so far, but for very different reasons?
Absolutely. Senator Baldwin has been a champion of sexual and reproductive health care and of abortion access for a very long time. So she is, of course, against this bill for the same reasons that I think a lot of people are, that it's an enormous transfer of wealth to those richest people for tax breaks at the expense of the general American public and the investments that they need in accessing health care, in affordable health care, in food, in clean energy, et cetera, et cetera. Senator Ron Johnson is a no, but as you mentioned, for very different reasons. And at this point in time, you know, a no is a no. And if this bill does not pass as is out of the Senate, there's, you know, more opportunity if this goes back to the House for people to engage and try to get this particular provision stricken from the bill. There's also an interesting procedural question that I think ought to come up in the Senate, and that's the Byrd Rule, which basically says you cannot create policy through a budget bill or this reconciliation bill, which essentially that's what this provision is. While it doesn't name Planned Parenthood, there's potentially only one other organization that would be in the entire country that would be impacted by this. In Wisconsin, the only healthcare provider impacted by this provision is Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. So it is, you know, very targeted. And it's not a cost savings to anyone. As I mentioned, it in fact increases the cost because for lots of reasons, right? So Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, just as all Planned Parenthoods, provide sexual reproductive health care, contraceptive care, and counseling. And so people will go without those things, and they may have unplanned pregnancies. 40% of all pregnancies and deliveries are covered by some form of taxpayer-subsidized Medicaid coverage. So that will increase costs if there's more unplanned pregnancies. People may not have their cancer detected early enough. That may cost, you know, for example, we had a patient write a wonderful letter to our staff thanking them for listening to her, for seeing her and taking her seriously. She had been to a few other providers and felt kind of brushed off in her concerns and complaints, and our staff found her cervical cancer, and she was able to get connected to treatment. And so those are the types of things that, you know, first and foremost impact people's individual lives. But in the broader picture, if people are waiting to get care or not able to get care until they're very ill, or they're having unplanned pregnancies that now need to be covered by Medicaid, all of those things essentially will impact the fiscal note of states and the federal government.
Michelle Velasquez, thank you so much for joining us on Like Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle Velasquez is Chief Strategy Officer of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin. She spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about how the federal budget could impact people on Medicaid seeking reproductive health care. Later in the show, we'll learn about the cuts at the 16th Street Community Health Centers and hear reactions from the community. But first, the Midwest is becoming kind of a haven for people seeking refuge from climate change. We'll learn how Milwaukee is preparing, coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Climate change has some people in parts of the U.S. rethinking where they live. Weather events that may have been considered once-in-a-generation occurrences are happening with increased intensity and frequency. So where do people go when the climate where they live is becoming a little too volatile? Well, the Midwest has become a top destination for climate migration. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, is joined by Fred Schnook, the executive director of the environmental nonprofit Wisconsin Clean Cities, to find out why.
What it means is that particularly around the coasts, people are really getting disrupted by climate change. It's far more evident in those coastal states, the impacts of climate change than it is here in the Midwest. Where it really impacts people is with regard to their home insurance. People are being denied home insurance if they live in flood-prone areas of Florida or if they live in fire-prone areas of California, let's say. Those are things that people have seen a lot of lately. Those people are looking to move. They're looking for more stable climates. And the Midwest has a far more stable climate. One, because it's in the middle of the continent. Two, because the Great Lakes are a mitigating force, which stabilizes the climate overall in this part of the country. Finally, there was a paper written in, I think, 2019 by a professor who said that Duluth was a climate haven. And a lot of people have grabbed onto that paper and are realizing that the Midwest is a place that can provide them with more stable opportunities for kind of long-term living than those coastal states.
You mentioned a professor who highlighted Duluth as the best place to be if you're looking to leave areas where climate change is wreaking havoc. Is there data available now that shows that climate migration is actually happening there?
Particularly from the West Coast, from California, from Oregon, and moving to the Duluth area. There's been scientific studies based on papers that have been written and then are tested. So, yes.
So, it could be happening in Wisconsin already. We just don't have the data. So, we can't really say what the impact is right now.
Correct. Correct. It's absolutely correct, Taryn.
What would be some challenges to collecting that data?
Well, finding the research dollars to do it, to actually have the researchers that would pull those people in. Two is awareness is really a big issue. I think in, particularly in Wisconsin, we don't realize how lucky we have it compared to some of these coastal regions that have seen some really tough impacts on climate change. Our coastal regions have seen some of it. In the last 2 years, there was a lot of flooding around the Great Lakes, but inside of Wisconsin, not much. And the flooding that we've had in the Great Lakes was really only about 2 feet. So while it certainly had an impact, it wasn't at the level, the extreme level, if you will, that they had in New York.
So you said awareness is a big issue, and that makes me think of the survey that you're a part of with the Community Sustainability Group under the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. This survey is looking to gauge people's understanding of climate change and climate migration. What can you tell us about how this survey came about and what we know so far?
Well, the survey came about based on the exact question that you asked, Taryn, which is, where are people at in terms of their awareness, right? So we knew we needed to come up with some kind of a survey instrument to really see where people are at. Otherwise, it only shows up when we hear from, you know, primarily municipal officials who are saying, we are concerned about climate impacts in our community. The example that that I'd like to cite is Monroe County. Monroe County has been dealing with a lot of flooding issues, and they're aware that the climate is changing and it's impacting their county. So they have asked us if there's some ways we can help them. They've worked with Greenfire to do a climate assessment. What they would like to do ultimately is to hold a climate summit. And as part of that summit, we would release this survey to people in Monroe County to gauge their level of acceptance or understanding of climate impacts in their county.
Are there any other goals for that survey?
I think that the survey is a starting point, Taryn. It then tells us, what do we do next? Based on the results of the survey and where people are at with their understanding of climate change and its impacts, how then do we get ready for that, right? So when I talk to people about climate migration, many times they're not even aware that climate is an issue. So we have to really find out where they're at, right? Mm-hmm. So they might not even be ready to hear about climate migration yet. We have to, you know, provide more education and training to those folks about what's really happening with the climate.
So let's put Milwaukee in the forefront for a second. What do you think is the best approach, in your opinion, to how Milwaukee could prepare for this? Who needs to be at the table, included in the conversation when we talk about, you know, not widening already existing inequities? Who needs to be at the decision-making table, the conversation table, so that everyone can benefit when climate migration impacts us?
It impacts us in so many different ways. And as you mentioned, ensuring that marginalized groups have a place at the table is critical. It's really, really critical because it tends to impact them more, right? So it's really important that we deal with the socioeconomic issues that are impacting the community. So the areas most prone to flooding, right? The areas most prone to other impacts of climate change are going to impact marginalized communities first. So it's really important that they have a place at the table in those discussions. I think in most areas where we've seen it start before is really with planning departments who understand climate change and then are able to pull communities together to deal with those issues. It shouldn't be separate from other planning that takes place in a community. So most big cities, particularly like Milwaukee, go through comprehensive planning on a regular basis. Comprehensive planning looks at planning through 9 different elements in the community. I would argue and hope that what Milwaukee does in the future is either does a climate overlay of those 9 elements or add a 10th element of climate change and climate migration to discuss how does that impact transportation? How does climate change impact housing? How does climate change impact the development on land use? How does that impact the relationships with the city of Milwaukee, with the surrounding suburbs? So to look at all of those elements through a climate change lens, to me, are really important.
That was Fred Schnook, the executive director of the environmental nonprofit Wisconsin Clean Cities. He spoke with WUWM's Taryn Powell as a part of our Climate Solutions Week reporting in partnership with NPR. Taryn also spoke with Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson. Milwaukee is already taking steps to address climate change in the city through its climate and equity plan. Mayor Johnson discusses his hope to grow Milwaukee's population and how the city is preparing for the potential of climate migration.
You've often talked about growing Milwaukee's economy and increasing the population. Was increasing the population, is that independent of Milwaukee's climate and equity plan or part of it?
It's separate from the climate and equity plan, although the plan does dovetail very well with that goal. And I think it dovetails well with the goal because the climate is not changing just here in Milwaukee. It's changing around the country. It's changing around the world. And I believe, and we already see this in some respects, that people will move because of a changing climate. And I think that a place like Milwaukee is ripe to reap the benefits in terms of population growth of that movement. That's not to say that we won't have challenges as it relates to climate. Every place will. But I think that we are well suited to address those challenges. Like that's the whole reason why we have the climate and equity plan. And then also have the benefit of having those additional people come to Milwaukee.
And so let's talk more about, climate migration. What do you know about climate migration?
I guess I'll give you this. I'm a part of this organization that focuses in on the economy and the health of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Seaway. It's a binational organization where mayors lead, mayors from the United States and mayors from Canada as well. And the executive director of that organization often talks about what's going on as it relates to climate, right? Out west, things are on fire. And we saw that, just a couple of months ago with the terrible, terrible fires that raged in Los Angeles. In the south, it's boiling. I mean, to the point where usually, or in the past, when I was a kid growing up, folks wanted to go down to Florida for summer vacation. I don't think many folks want to go to Florida for summer vacation these days. And then, out east, there are significant floods. I mean, you're on the path of the hurricanes, right? We saw the Superstorm Sandy a number of years ago in New York and New Jersey and other places. We are pretty well isolated from those larger scale natural disasters in the Midwest and, of course, here in Milwaukee. And so I think as people seek to leave those climate disasters that are happening with much more intensity and strength every single year, they will migrate to other parts of the country, places that are more moderate, places that are more temperate, and Milwaukee is on that list.
Just looking at the climate and equity plan, I did see mention of climate migration and with your goal of growing the population. Like this particularly was talking about the need for more housing. And so talk a little bit about that. Like how soon could we see houses being built? I just wonder, where will these houses be? Who are the stakeholders, committees, talking about this?
Well, I think we need to be prepared for climate migration. I also think that we need to do a better job of making sure that the people who presently live in Milwaukee have access to safe, affordable housing in the city as it is. Even if you take, climate migration off the table, there's a need to have, some 30,000 additional units for African-American, for Latino homeowners in the city of Milwaukee, folks who want to break out into other, housing choices, housing units. That's why I'm very, very happy, very, very proud that the City Plan Commission just this Monday approved my housing policy, the housing element, a larger part of Growing Milwaukee initiative, to make sure that there's more availability to build the different types of housing choices that we need in Milwaukee so that we can also lower the cost, right? Because Milwaukee just a couple of weeks ago was named by the Washington Post, I believe, as the most, or one of the most cutthroat rental markets in the United States. I love New York. I don't want to be compared to New York as it relates to as much money as it takes to rent an apartment here in Milwaukee. So we're working to make sure that it's easier to develop in Milwaukee so that folks who live here have the opportunity, but then also making sure that we have the space for the people who I believe will come here. And look, I knock on doors in my job as mayor. I did the same thing when I was alderman. I've already met people who have moved here because of climate disasters where they originally hailed from in the United States.
You know, I asked that especially looking at the conditions that already exist in Milwaukee, like racial disparities and such. We know that climate change will exacerbate those disparities that already exist. So I just wonder, in the case that climate migration, well, you just mentioned you know people who have moved for climate related reasons, moved to Milwaukee already. With that being a reality, climate migration, how do you see it faring for Milwaukee, whether it's good or bad, or do you think it's both?
I think it could be a good thing. This is something that's going to happen. People will leave when there's turmoil, whether it's, you know, economic, whether it's political, whether it's violence, whether it's climate related, from where they are to get to a better space. Milwaukee presents that better space, and so I think people ultimately will come. It's our responsibility to make sure we're setting the city on a responsible path to make sure that the folks who stay here are able to stay here, right? That's why it's important for us to build more affordable housing. That's why it's important for us to make sure we have more developments in the city that, you know, promote density and making a space for the future people who will come here as well. And those are the things that we're doing in Milwaukee. You just touched on, though, you know, some of the race-based challenges that have been present here, and not just here, but in other places as well. That's exactly why in our climate and equity plan, it specifically says that we want to work to make sure that, you know, people who have been shut out of opportunities, typically people of color, African-Americans, Latinos, Asians alike, that they have the opportunity to work in jobs in the green sector. So we're working to make sure that we are able to maintain the people who are here, working to make sure we bring on new spaces for the folks who will come here, but then also working to maintain an opportunity for people who live in Milwaukee, who has always called Milwaukee home, to continue to call Milwaukee home, and that's very important to me.
What would community input look like, you know, as the city is developing these plans, for people to have an opportunity to even say, like, hey, we don't want this, or we do, or here's what we think this should look like? Would there be, like, community forum spaces like that?
Yeah, I mean, the climate and equity plan, again, this passed, you know, a couple of years ago, and I was proud to sign it into law. It came out of a task force, a city-county task force on climate and equity. And so we had people from the community sitting on that task force that were engaged in the process. I believe there were listening sessions on this as well. I have to go back and confirm that. But I believe with everything that is in my head, I believe that was the case too on that. So we created the space for that to happen. And then as it relates to the housing element, that was passed by the City Plan Commission. I mean, there were so many opportunities for community outreach, so many opportunities for community engagement. I mean, even the meeting just this past Monday where the CPC, the City Plan Commission, approved the plan, that was an opportunity for residents in Milwaukee to come and voice their opinions about it too in that forum. There will be continued conversations about it. That's been forwarded now after CPC approval to the Common Council. And so a council committee, the requisite council committee, will take it up, and that'll be an opportunity for people to reach out to their representatives on the city council to continue to have their voices heard as we move through this process.
Unless you have really experienced the climate change impacts, or like you really pay attention to the issue, like you're in groups who pay attention to this, maybe folks aren't even really thinking about climate migration right now. But I mean, what can you tell them as far as like how Milwaukee is preparing for this, for everyone to benefit?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think for many folks, because you're here, right? So you already benefit from not being in a place that is stricken by, you know, these really, really adverse climate disasters, because we're, you know, more moderate in terms of that when you look across the country. So folks may not be paying so much attention to it. I'm paying a lot of attention to it as mayor, because I think, you know, our city needs to be prepared, not just for now, but for 20 years from now. And so I think people should know that we're taking steps to make sure that when and if, and I think it's more of a when, you know, more people come here as they flee away from hurricanes, as they flee away from, you know, wildfires, as they flee away from sweltering heat, as they flee away from places that unfortunately don't have access to stable sources of water. I mean, you've got in this country, in the United States already, you know, places out west where their water sources are drying up. You know, I have read where there have been subdivision developments that have had to stop developing because they didn't have enough water to support the people who would live there. But here in Milwaukee, right, we've got Lake Michigan. We've got an inland sea that is plentiful. And with the Great Lakes Compact, that water resource, it stays here. It stays here. So people are more than welcome to come here and enjoy the lake and the water and the clean drinking water that we have, but it's not going to get shipped out to the desert in Arizona, you know, for instance, or Nevada or places like that. So that's something that I think we have to continue to pay attention to. I am paying attention to it. We're going to continue to make sure that we build affordable housing in the city. We're going to continue to make sure that we're focused on creating more density in the city, which, by the way, is good for existing businesses in Milwaukee, existing commercial corridors and businesses there in the city of Milwaukee. We're going to work to make sure we're building out opportunities for more people to call Milwaukee home. We're going to continue to make sure we're focused in on the climate impacts by looking for alternative energy sources for city buildings. We're going to continue to make sure that we're looking out for opportunities to electrify our vehicle fleet in the city of Milwaukee, whether it's in the Department of Public Works, whether it's in the Milwaukee Police Department, the like. We're going to continue to make sure we're building out a protected bikeway system so that less people in our city have to rely on a car in order to get from where they are, and not then therefore contributing more to the climate crisis. So there's a lot of things that we're doing in the city of Milwaukee. I'm very, very proud of them, and it's going to take some time, but I think all together as a community we'll get there.
That was Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson speaking with WUWM's Taryn Powell. That reporting is part of the work for Climate Solutions Week. You can find more reporting at WUWM.com. We've got a new season of Bulber Talk going, and we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area that you've probably always wondered about at WUWM.com. Coming up next, the 16th Street Community Health Centers has cut its environmental health department. We'll look at the impact, so stay tuned to Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. 16th Street Community Health Centers is a fixture on Milwaukee's South Side. When its doors opened in 1969, it was the first community health care center in the whole state. It serves residents regardless of linguistic, cultural, or economic barriers. In 1997, 16th Street expanded its services by creating its Department of Environmental Health. Over the decades, the department has championed initiatives including Milwaukee's revitalization of the Menominee Valley and the long process of naturalizing the Kinnickinnick River. Last month, 16th Street abruptly laid off environmental health staff members and halted some of its programs. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz got reactions from several people. We'll hear first from Iris Gonzalez, a former member of the environmental health team at 16th Street.
I worked at 16th Street for, I think, almost 5 years in the Department of Environmental Health, and I was mainly doing outreach and community organizing work in the neighborhoods where 16th Street has patients who are experiencing different environmental hazards and climate shocks. And so that meant primarily neighborhoods where there was flooding and there was pollution and there were opportunities to improve quality of life. And so our work was really focused on getting outside of the clinic walls and addressing some of the root causes of the illnesses that we were treating inside of the clinic. And it was a really fun job. It was one of my favorite jobs I ever had and some of the best work I think I've ever done in my career, to be focused at the intersection of health and environment and climate and neighborhood revitalization, and really empowering and supporting community leaders like Esperanza and her awesome neighbors here in the K River neighborhood.
You mentioned when we first were in conversation about what's happening with the Environmental Health Department that this is just a rich, strong, important legacy that's being interrupted at best. What is your concern about what is unfolding, that there may not be an environmental health arm of 16th Street Community Health Centers?
You know, it's really heartbreaking to think about this awesome team and the legacy of this work. The Department of Environmental Health has really been very active and instrumental in revitalizing at least three major spaces in Milwaukee, starting with the Menominee Valley, and then also in the Kinnickinnick River neighborhood, and then also in the Harbor District. And so, you know, the folks at the Environmental Health Division were people who were known for coalition building, bringing folks together, helping to think sort of holistically beyond what was possible. You know, in the case of the Menominee Valley, a bunch of piles of contaminated dirt and brownfields, and thinking about what revitalization could look like and could mean there. And similarly here in the KK, helping to advocate for change and for investment in a place that had been forgotten and disinvested for a long time. And I think that 16th Street's Department of Environmental Health was one of the first in the nation. It's very unusual to have a federally qualified community health center with a dedicated team of folks that are getting into the community, doing that upstream work, you know, in the public health space. The social determinants of health is still something that's a big topic of conversation. And I think 16th Street was a trailblazer in actually operationalizing that and having dedicated staff and resources doing that work. And so I think, you know, when you talk to community members that have benefited from that, it really, you can see the impact, the lasting impact that sometimes is hard to see or hard to measure. It takes a long time. But it has definitely had a big impact.
So Esperanza, what has it meant to you as a person who cares actively, works actively for your family, for your neighbors, in the work that you've been able to do with the 16th Street Community Health Center's Environmental Health Department?
I've been involved with them since the beginning, almost 15 years, due to the redo of the river to its natural base. They said that they were going to demolish houses, and mine is far from the river, so it's like, I just moved in here. The only thing I want to leave here is with my feet first. I don't want to move anymore. This one's perfect, so it hit home. The creation of the Kinnickinnick River through 16th Street was great, and a lot of people have evolved. It's a whole generation with the love for nature.
So many layers, embracing the neighborhood, caring for it, nurturing it.
In COVID, it was our clinic. By the bridge, there's steps, and you can see people either celebrating with their hands open up and, you know, just taking in sun, or you can just see them focusing and listening to the babbling brook. There's times where you just need to hear the water so you can clear your brain. We call them sound baths and forest baths, and in Spanish, baño de sol, sun baths. So it's also healthy.
Through the years, you've developed a close working relationship with the environmental health team from 16th Street. How has that enriched both what you do and what you see happening in your community?
We did picnics, we did the artwork. Everything was coordinated through them. We need partnerships in order to survive. 16th Street would knock on the doors and give flyers of the activities we did so people know where we were. They helped us apply for the monies and the fundings. One of the major funding was with MMSD and revitalizing the river. And that has turned international type of a program. People from other countries have come in for tours because they saw the federal, the state, the county, the city, and the neighbors. You know, if you let a person have a voice, they take ownership. And once they take ownership, they pick up. With the redesign, we save lives because the water in the other way was made to rush out. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we lost three a couple years. They also have found trout back there by the pool now that they're coming up. They've spotted some deers, wild turkeys. A lot of new life has come back. So it's healthy for nature, and it's healthy for us, and Mother Nature as a whole. So they coordinated all our activities together. Mm-hmm. So that's a major program that we've lost, a key program. So it's a major loss, not only personally, but as a community, the whole South Side. Yeah.
So, Vicki Elkin, Executive Director of Fund for Lake Michigan, in hearing all of this and in your relationship over the years with 16th Street's Environmental Health Department, what are you thinking right now? What stands out?
The Fund for Lake Michigan started making grants in 2011. We are a private foundation based in Milwaukee with a mission to improve water quality in the region. And early on, we realized that the KK River watershed desperately needed help. It is literally the most densely populated watershed in the state of Wisconsin and has the highest percentage of impervious surface. So given these conditions and the fact that the river was channelized, water quality, flooding, and public safety was really a huge issue in this area. Esperanza mentioned the drownings. These aren't anything new, unfortunately, but something that's been going on for decades. I cannot overstate the importance of the role of 16th Street Community Health Center in the work that's happened there. So when we first started making grants in 2011, we were very, very happy to connect with 16th Street and learn about their work with neighbors in the KK area. And at that time, and I'm sure Iris was involved in this, at that time they were working with individual homeowners and neighbors to do things like rain gardens and rain barrels. And, you know, in the context of the flooding that was going on in the area, these were, you know, very, very, very small improvements. But the philosophy was, if you get people to take action themselves or understand why this is important and then do something about it, it's so much easier than to become an advocate when it comes time to city investments or MMSD's major projects. So over the course of 15 years, we've really seen that play out. And so when it comes to some of the larger projects like MMSD's renaturalization of the KK through Pulaski Park and in other areas of the watershed, 16th Street Community Health Center and the residents have played a huge role in how those projects have looked. They reflect community priorities. They are not only supported by the community, but celebrated by the community. So one thing that really stands out in my mind, and Esperanza referenced this, is the fact that dozens of houses had to be removed from the floodplain. And getting to the point where the community could understand this and maybe not oppose it, that would be huge in and of itself. But because of 16th Street, the community actually appreciated it, wanted it, and celebrated it. So, you know, you can't overestimate the importance of those kind of citizen involvement. And, you know, I am very, very disappointed to hear that this program is on a pause or has been eliminated by 16th Street Community Health Center. I do think there will be a legacy of people like Esperanza that will continue to be an advocate for the river, but it's just really a shame. So, you know, I think 16th Street really was a leader in this area, and, you know, there's clearly a lot more work to be done. So having such a trusted voice in the community to do this work, I mean, this is where people go to have their babies or get their immunizations or take their kids where they're sick, and that, you know, no one else is really in that position.
What thoughts do you have, Ms. Esperanza? What's standing out for you right now?
The loss. And she is right. If you don't put the community that lives there, they have to own it. So if the community owns it, they will do the stewardship. What bothers me is that Who made the decision and why? Didn't they value what they had? We valued it. We weren't asked.
That was Esperanza Gutierrez, a Southside resident active with the 16th Street Community Health Centers. You also heard from Iris Gonzalez, a former member of the Environmental Health Team, and Vicki Elkin, the Executive Director of Fund for Lake Michigan. A spokesperson for 16th Street shared a statement with WUWM that says in part, "For a variety of organizational reasons, we made the decision to pause the neighborhood revitalization program and community wellness sessions, which included 5 staff positions. We continue to evaluate the needs of the community and our ability to meet those needs." You can find the full statement from 16th Street and more information as well about these cuts at WUWM.com. And that wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on the show, we'll look at the abortion cases before the state Supreme Court. Plus, we'll learn the lore of the Milwaukee Public Library's summer reading program mascots. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.